Wonder why that is. It must be the round button or something. Well, at any rate, this is the first of the Augusta Week 4 concerts, storytelling. I'm R.P. Hale. I'm teaching one of the Hammer Dulcimer classes. And tonight, the storyteller tonight is particularly special. She's been here before. And after a hiatus, she's come back. It's always nice when we get them back. What happens when she came back, though, is another thing. Her class got put between the two Hammer Dulcimer classes. So far, so good. We've been quiet. Well, when one of them is an O'Carolan class and the other one is a backup class, there's not too much that can go on. Not bad for Hammer Dulcimers. Well, at any rate, Connie Reagan Blake is from Asheville, North Carolina. She's been a storyteller for quite some time. Her career has taken her through 44 states and 12 countries. And we're particularly pleased to have her back here teaching the storytelling class and equally pleased to have her back here at Augusta. So if you want to give a welcome to Connie Reagan Blake, that'd be great.
Thank you very much. It's great to be back in Elkins. Long time ago, after I had traveled for about 3 years around the country full-time with my cousin and storytelling partner in the Datsun pickup truck with a big camper on the back, we were trying to decide where we were going to live, and Elkins made the top three list for us. So Asheville just won out by just a little bit. I'm down in North Carolina in the mountains down there. It is great to be here, too, and it's nice to just be back on this stage because I have fond memories. I first came to Augusta back in 1977 and took a class in storytelling from a person that became a dear friend. She's a folklorist here in West Virginia, and she's sitting right here, Judy Byers. And I'm going to, in her honor, tell a story that comes from West Virginia. I'll use this little ocarina in honor of all the music that's going on this weekend. I like those stories that have a bit of the mysterious in them. This story certainly has that. It was the call of that bird that somehow sent a chill down her spine and at the same time made her feel at home. You see, Sally Milton had just moved to West Virginia, and it was like stepping back in time. She'd graduated from the University of Pennsylvania, and she taught school for a few years up in Pittsburgh. But like all other teachers, you might know this too, she never seemed to have enough time to do anything else. And her real love, her real passion, after the children, was painting. She could just get lost in her watercolors. And then a friend of hers told her about a small, isolated mountain community down in West Virginia. They were looking for a teacher. She'd be the only teacher for 12 children. Well, something about it just sounded right. So she decided to go down and interview for the job. Once she got there, she met Mrs. Frances May Tompkins, head of the school committee. Now, she was an older woman. Sally liked her right away. She had kind of a direct manner, and you could just tell she wanted what was best for the children. She told Sally that her room and board would be provided for. She could come and go as she pleased. And then she said, "Now, I know we can't pay what they pay in the big city. So to compensate for that, we've arranged for you to do all of your lesson planning during the school day. When the end of school comes, you'll be finished." Now that sounded just perfect to Sally. It meant her late afternoons would be free for painting, just when the light of the sun was at its best. Then Miss Tompkins showed her the rooms that would be hers, two rooms with a long bank of windows overlooking the South Jaw River. That cinched the deal. Within 2 weeks, she had moved down there. And her first day of school, it was great. Practically the whole town turned out to welcome her. The children were all in their best behavior. And by 2:30 in the afternoon, she was finished. Well, the first few months, things went really wonderfully well. She was welcomed by all the people, and then it came to her. She thought that she'd have the children put on a skit a play for Thanksgiving. She'd make all the costumes and design the set, and then she'd invite the townspeople, kind of a way to say thank you. She decided to stay after school and work on the project. Once the children had left, she realized it was the first time she'd been alone in that room. Well, she started working. She was up at the desk, and all of a sudden, she heard the call of that bird. A cold wave of air came in the room, and Sally realized she wasn't alone. She looked up, and in the back of the room, there was a child standing there, a girl she'd never seen before. She looked to be about 8 or 9 years old. She was dressed in old-fashioned clothes, had on a calico skirt, went all the way down to the floor, a muslin shirt there. She was holding on to a book, and she had her hand raised. "Teacher, teacher, please tell me what my homework is, and where is my rag doll?" Well, Sally was so startled, she stood up and the child dropped the book and ran out of the classroom. Sally walked to the back of the room and she picked up that book and she saw that it was an old primer. Well, it had been published in 1892. Well, she went straight to Miss Tompkins, and over a cup of tea, the older woman told her how that schoolhouse had been haunted by that ghost for years. They could never keep a teacher more than just a few months. And it seemed that the ghost always appeared in the late afternoon. That's why they'd arranged for Sally to be gone by the 2:30. Well, that evening, Sally went upstairs to her room and she sat down and she stitched up a rag doll. The next day, she was there in the classroom waiting. And it was the same. She heard that bird. Felt that same cold wave of air, and all of a sudden, there was the child, just as the day before, with her hand raised. "Teacher, teacher, please tell me what my homework is, and where is my rag doll?" Well, this time, Sally stood up very slowly. She had the book in one hand and the rag doll in the other, and she started walking towards the back of the room. She said, "Child, I want you to read the first 3 pages in this book, and here's your rag doll." The little girl reached out and took them both, and she curtsied and turned around. Sally followed her to the door, but as soon as she got there, she was gone. Once again, Sally went to the older woman, and Miss Tompkins asked her if she wouldn't take a walk with her. They began walking towards the outskirts of town, and as they walked along, Miss Tompkins told her how that child had been murdered on her way home from school. Legend had it that she'd been inseparable from her rag doll, but after the killing, they'd never been able to find it. By the time she finished talking, they had reached the old part of the cemetery, and there was a gravestone there. They were standing right in front of it. It read, "Samantha Jones, born 1902, died 1910. And laying up right next to that gravestone was that rag doll Sally had made the night before. Now, Sally, she figured that that child's ghost must be at rest because she never did see it again. But every once in a while, she'd hear the call of that bird. Thank you. Thank you. In case you're interested in more ghost stories like that, this is the book that it comes from. Judy's main mentor was Ruth Ann Music, and she put out several collections of stories that come from West Virginia. She did a lot of collecting in her day, and Judy is in process of putting out some more of those books, so be sure to be on the lookout for them. This week in our storytelling class, I have a great group of folks here, and one of my goals in storytelling, and in some ways maybe just in life in general, is to kind of be present moment by moment. There's a Japanese saying, it's saku taku no ki, and the saku is when a mother hen comes over and taps on the egg. And the taku is when the baby chick about to be born and hatched on the inside is tapping. And a saku taku noki comes when they're tapping at the same time. And I hope that I have a feeling here at Augusta we'll all have lots of those moments where we're all and everything is tapping at the same time. I was at a conference a couple of weeks ago, the National Storytelling Conference, and the keynote speaker was Sophie Burnham. You might be familiar with her. She's written several books about angels. And one of the stories that she told, a little thing that happened to her, has really stayed with me. And we were at a bookstore this evening and saw one of her books, The Book of Angels, it's called. And I thought I might tell you about this. She has written about angel experiences she's had herself, and also friends and people that have come and told her about some different kinds of experiences that they explain as being angels. But she said once she was in New York City and being interviewed on a radio show. And the radio interviewer told her about this. There was some friends of his, a married couple, that had two children. They had a three-year-old, and then they had just had a new baby. The baby had just been home from the hospital about a week. And the little girl, the three-year-old, kept saying that she wanted to be alone with the baby. You know, the parents had heard stories about kids being jealous and stuff, and they didn't know if maybe was going to bop them in the head, or they didn't know what she was going to do. But she was so persistent that they kept, you know, thinking, well, maybe we're going to have to do this. And finally, after about 4 days had gone by, and she was asking every single moment that she had the chance, they decided that they would. And they had a monitor in the baby's bedroom, and so they thought they could hear and they'd be close by, and if anything happened, they'd rush right in. So they left, and the little girl was in there, and they went to the monitor to listen, and they heard her lean across the crib there and say, "Tell me about God. I'm forgetting." And sometimes I think that it is through our stories that we can remember. I'd like to tell you a new story for me. This is one that's in sign language. And sign language is so wonderful for stories. I don't really know a lot of sign language. I just kind of put together some stories sometimes with folks that know sign language. So I'll give this one a try for you. It's another look at God, I guess, and at the big picture of things. A long time ago, there was an old man and woman. They were married, and they had lived a good life. And God looked down, and he was pleased. And he sent an angel to give them a wish. The old couple, they said that they wanted to see heaven and hell. The angel said, "Have courage, close your eyes." And he reached out and he took them all the way down, and they arrived in hell. They opened their eyes. They were surprised. There were lush green fields and big trees with big trunks shading tables with white tablecloths. The tables were laden with food, bowls and plates and platters and pitchers stretching in both directions. They walked closer and they saw that there were people sitting up and down the table, but the people were thin and gaunt and angry. And so they went even closer, and they saw that all the people, all of them, had wooden braces on their arms. They could not bend their elbows, and they were starving. The old couple, they asked the angel to take them away. And the angel said, "Have courage, close your eyes." And he reached out and he took them all the way until they arrived in heaven. They opened their eyes, and they were surprised. It was the same. Lush green fields, big trees with big trunks, shading tables with white tablecloths. The tables were laden with food, bowls and platters and plates and pitchers stretching in both directions. But the people, they were laughing and talking. They were robust and healthy. And so the couple, they walked closer, and they saw it was the same. They had wooden braces on their arms, and they could not bend their elbows. But each was feeding his neighbor. Thank you. Thank you very much. I learned that story from John Basinger. He's one of the folks that was real instrumental in starting the National Theater of the Deaf up in Connecticut. He's a wonderful signer and performer with his signing. And as I said, I'm still kind of working on it. So if some of you folks know sign language, you might know a few of them there. I'm still getting my fingers coordinated with my words. But sign language is such a great language, I think, for storytelling. And there are over 20 million people in the United States that are hearing impaired. That's enough people to fill up over a dozen states. So it might be really wonderful if more and more of us learn sign language. The very first story that I ever told in sign language was one that was a bit more for children. It's called I Know an Old Lady Who Swallowed a Fly. I don't know why she swallowed a fly. I guess she'll die. And it goes through all the animals, which are kind of fun, spider and bird. How absurd to swallow a bird. And I've had one of my first chances to tell that story at a storytelling festival up in Long Island. And the whole storytelling festival was being signed, which I thought was really great. So the signers were on stage, and I thought this would be a great chance to try out this story. And I asked one of the signers if she wouldn't let me go over it with her ahead of time. She said she'd be glad to, and we kind of slipped down a hallway, and I did the story. And when I finished, she said she thought I'd do fine with it. But she said she could definitely tell that I had learned it in the South. She said I had a Southern accent with my signs. I thought that was pretty amazing. But sure enough, come to find out there are different kinds of regional signs. And so that does happen. You know, in thinking about that story about our neighbors, feeding our neighbors, I guess that's the broad sense of the word of neighbors. I think it's one that the world would maybe be a little better off if we all had some more of those concepts of making it bigger than family or who lives next door does. But family sure is a great place to get stories. Now, I grew up, spent a lot of my growing up time at an uncle's place down in Florida. He was in Palatka, Florida. Actually, he was in East Palatka, Florida. He was on the east side of the St. John's River, and he was right on the river there. It was a great place to go as a kid. They had 7 horses, and they had the river. They had a dock going out and what we called a summer house that had a ping pong table, and it was lots of fun down there. There were 13 of us cousins, and we spent a lot of time together. Now, I'm going to tell you a little story that happened down there, but I need to start off by telling you that my cousins don't necessarily believe this. So you can decide for yourself. But each of us actually had our own little way and methods of fishing. You know, my grandfather used to take dough balls. He'd take the center part of white bread and roll it up and set those dough balls up and down the dock, and then he'd reach over and put that in on a hook on a cane pole and catch a few brim, usually about that big. Maybe a little bit smaller, too. But I had a different kind of a method for fishing, and I was sitting, I had my own little place there. It was shaded by a big old live oak tree with that heavy moss hanging down from it, and I was hidden a little bit there, which I liked, and I was sitting there fishing one day, and my cousin Cindy walked up, and she said, "Connie, what you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm fishing." She said, well, I don't see a pole or anything. And I said, nope, don't need one. She said, well, you don't have a line or... And I said, nope, don't need one. She said, well, you don't even have a hook. Or I said, nope, don't need one. She said, well, if you don't have a pole or a line or a hook, how are you fishing? And I told her, said, I got me this here plug of chewing tobacco. And what you do see is just kind of break off a little bit of that chewing tobacco and kind of splink it down over the water. Those fish, they just come right up to the surface, grab some of that chewing tobacco, and dive back down into the water. She looked like she didn't quite understand. She said, I still don't see how that's fishing. And I said, well, Cindy, they got to come up to spit. And when they do, I got me a stick here, and I just hit them over the head. Well, she said, have you caught many? I said, well, just the other day, I caught me a 9-pound minnow. She looked very impressed. Then she said, well, Connie, I got something to tell you. She said, I was out just a couple of weeks ago doing a little bit of fishing with in the evening time. Actually, I was doing some shrimping that evening, and I had Pop's lantern there. You do shrimping in the late after very early evening part when it's just starting to get dark. She said, I had our grandfather Pop's lantern, and she said, I was just getting ready to cast out, had a big old round net with weights all the way around the circle, and you put some of those weights, put one of those weights in your mouth, and then you just kind of cast it out, and it circles up and goes right down and gets some of those fresh shrimp. And so she said, I was getting ready to cast out, and she said, and I knocked that lantern, and it went right into the water. I said, oh, I thought that was a shame. She said, yeah, yeah, but here's what I need to tell you. She said, I was out just two nights ago doing some regular fishing, you know, with a hook and all, and I hooked up that self-same lantern. I said, well, Cindy, you know, I've heard about that kind of thing before, you know, with boots and all. And she said, yeah, Connie, but that lantern, it was still lit. And that's when I told her, I said, Cindy, I'll take 9 3/4 pounds, 8 3/4 pounds off that minnow if you'll at least blow out that lantern. Thanks, sir. Thank you. That same thing happened to Lewis Goff, too, up in New Hampshire. It'll take me just a little bit of water here. About 10 years ago, my cousin and I, Barbara Freeman, and I got together with two other people and wrote a two-act play called Mountain Sweet Talk. We ran for 8 seasons down in Asheville in the summertime and in the fall. It was our way to kind of get to stay at home, and it was also a great adventure of working on kind of the same material night after night. Storytellers don't usually get a chance to do that because it's take a lot from the audience in deciding what stories we're going to tell and for how we're feeling that evening. But this was a different kind of an experience, a really good one. And it was partly autobiographical about our great Aunt Jenny and her raising up in the mountains of two nieces, Sarah and Jenny Rose. Partly it came from traditional stories kind of woven together. I'd like to tell you a story about Great Aunt Jenny and some of her experiences, one of her experiences. And it's a story that actually grew out of a Christmas celebration performance that we did about those same characters that are in the play. Every Christmas, since I can remember, our great Aunt Jenny hand stitches us up a handkerchief as a gift. Says she sews in all the memories for that year. My memories are intertwined with my cousin, Jenny Rose. She and I grew up together. We used to shadow each other every step of the way. Aunt Jenny would say, close as eggs in a basket. Now, we used to love to listen to the old folks talk. Aunt Jenny would have one of the neighbor women over visiting. They'd be sitting out on the front porch, and we'd come around the back of the cabin there and kind of lean in and lean in, and Aunt Jenny would catch sight of us and say, my two little bunny rabbits. trying to get an earful. Now you two scoot on in here closer so you can hear every word. That's the kind of a woman she was. She told us that we reminded her of Charlie Franklin. Charlie, he loved the old folks, said he trusted the old ways a lot better than anything newfangled. He was born over in England, and when he was still a baby, his family moved and settled in the mountains of western North Carolina. He and Aunt Jenny grew up together. Now, sometimes she'd tell us about Charlie and his first Christmas away from home. Now, you don't often think about war and Christmas going together, but it was 1914, and across the oceans over in Europe, the first great war had started. Now, Charlie, he is just 17. He's busy looking for his first whiskers. His uncle had told him, "Sign of a man, Charles, sign of a man." And that's when Charlie decided he was going to sign up for the war. He went to his mom and he said, "Now, Mama, I'm going. You can't talk me out of it. I'm Brit-born. It's an adventure." And our Aunt Jenny, she was just 16 at the time. I think she was kind of sweet on him. She hand-stitched him up a handkerchief to take with him. Put his name right across the middle, big blue letters. It said, "Charlie." Charlie said he'd keep that with him the whole time he was gone. Now, most folks around home had never even been out of the county they were born in, and here Charlie was going all the way over to Europe. He walked down into Burnsville, the county seat, caught a ride over to Bristol. Then he took a train all the way up to New York City, and he shipped off for the war. He found himself on a battlefield in France. He's out in the countryside just south of Paris. It was Christmas Eve, and Charlie, he was in the trenches, dug out holes in the ground. It'd been raining a lot, and then it turned real cold. Where they'd been sloshing around in the mud, now was frozen peaks of dirt. The staff sergeant had told them to keep their feet moving so frostbite wouldn't set in. Now, Charlie, he was with the French and the Brits, not more than 100 yards across, were the Germans in their trenches. No man's land, they called that in between. Now, Charlie, he was thinking about Christmas back home, thinking about his mom and brothers and sisters, wondering whether they'd put out a stocking for him. He usually got an orange, a few hickory nuts, a piece of peppermint. He could almost taste that peppermint in his mouth, that coolness drifting down his throat. He'd always try to hold on to it, make it last as long as he could. He wondered whether they'd save that peppermint till he got home. Then he felt something cold next to him, and he realized it was the cold metal of his rifle, and he remembered where he was. A cold shiver ran through him. It was dark and late. The moon hadn't come out, and he was scared. Every man was scared, wondering whether the next bullet was meant for him. And out of that darkness and quietness, Charlie, he said he heard something. Somebody was singing. Well, it seemed so strange on the battlefield. When he finished, one of those Brits started in singing, "God rest ye merry gentlemen, let nothing you dismay. Remember Christ our Savior was born on Christmas Day." When he was finished, the quiet was even bigger then. And then Charlie, he said, "I heard something else. The tune, it was familiar, but the words, they were strange. Steely knocked. And then I realized one of those Germans, he was singing Silent Night. Well, it was so beautiful. I was trembling, almost crying from the beauty of it. Then one of the French started in singing, and then the Brits. And there we were. We were all singing the same song, singing it the same, but in different languages. Well, it almost took my breath away. Then I felt the guy next to me kind of tighten up, and I saw he had his rifle pointed towards no man's land, so I just naturally picked up mine, and I pointed in the same direction, and I saw one of those Germans come striding across that no man's land, and I thought that singing had it all been a trick. And I caught him in my sights. And I saw he was waving a truce flag. It was shining like a star, and he was still singing. And then another German got up, and another. And I remembered that sweet Jenny's handkerchief. I took it out, and I tied it onto a stick, and I got up, and I started walking to the middle. My buddies, they were following me. And there we were in the middle of that no man's land, still singing that song. Once we finished, all of a sudden a ball appeared, and somebody hit it, and they were running up and down, and I was watching. A Brit ran by me, and he said, "Just kick it, mate, just kick it." So the next time it rolled by, I kicked it, and I started running. We were laughing, trying to find that ball in the darkness. Someone yelled, "Can't see, light up the flares." And before we knew it, there were flares lit up all the way around, ringing that no man's land like it was a playing field. We must have been out there for hours. When we finished, a few of us gathered around one of those flares like it was a warm fire, exchanging souvenirs, chocolates, cigarettes. One of those German boys took out a photograph, showed it to me. Must have been his family. And I took out one of mine. It's my mom and brothers and sisters. I was in it too. We were all standing in front of the house. So I pointed where I was and back, and it was like we were talking, even though we didn't understand each other's words. Well, all too soon, first light of dawn come in the sky. And France was France again. The Germans, they started walking back to their trenches, and we headed back to ours. And I caught sight of a fella, a young German soldier, looked to be about my age. He grinned at me, and he grinned just like Danny Harmon back home. But I knew it wasn't Danny. Well, he stood there looking for a moment, and then he turned around, went back to his trench. I went back to mine, picked up my rifle, and got ready for war again. But things had changed. It'd never be the same, because whoever was there that night, whenever we were looking down the sights of our rifle, we were wondering who was on the other end, what family we'd be killing into. Things had changed. And Charlie Franklin, he came back home to the mountains after the war, and Aunt Jenny should remember how it was that they'd go and visit the old folks, because that's what Charlie liked best. And he'd always tell them about his Christmas in the trenches. Then Aunt Jenny's voice would go down to a whisper. She'd tell us how it wasn't 18 months later that Charlie Franklin died, took sick with influenza and passed away. And Charlie's mama, she gave Aunt Jenny that handkerchief. And every Christmas, Aunt Jenny wears it tucked in her sleeve like it's a piece of fine jewelry. And she says, "Oh, girls, if only we could keep Christmas in our hearts all year long." And that's Charlie's truce flag. Thank you. It's been an interesting evening for me. I usually sit down for all my stories, and I just realized I've been standing for all those, so that's kind of different. It's actually different for me to be up here on stage, too, by myself. My partner Barbara and I did storytelling for 20 years. July 1st, it was our 20th year. And now we're kind of going off in new directions. We're both doing solo work now. And I'm going to be working with a chamber music trio, Kandinsky Trio. They're from down in Virginia, at least for the 95-96 season. And there's been original music written to a story that I'm going to tell. And we're going to tour up and down the East Coast from Maine, down several places here in West Virginia, and lots up in Pennsylvania, down through Tennessee and North Carolina and such. So you might be on the lookout for that. It's called Tales of Appalachia. And I do have some schedules with me, too. So if you're interested, I can give one of those to you. It's a great concept, too. I think it's been a very interesting collaboration, bringing that chamber music and storytelling, kind of the folk influences to the chamber music together, and having new music written. I think it's gonna be really good. Hopefully it'll blow people's socks off. That's what my plan is. You know, I'll give you a little bit of a story that you can take home with you. I got this from my mama. She's 83, and I always am delighted to hear her say that, we'll be talking on the phone or something, and she tells me about going to work with the old folks. She has a lot of volunteer work that she does, so she has a real good attitude and gets around really well. I hope that I have that same kind of energy and stamina by the time I'm her age. But here's a little ditty that she told me. The telephone rang, and a little boy answered and said, "Hello." A voice at the other end said, "Is your mama there?" "Yes." "May I speak to her, please?" "She's busy." "Oh, is your daddy there?" "Yes." "May I speak to him?" "He's busy." "Oh, was anybody else there?" "Just the policeman." "Oh, well, may I speak to him?" "He's busy." "Well, what in the world are they all doing?" "They are all looking for me." So that's one you can take home with you. I have just a couple of more little things to tell you about and stories to tell you. I have so many wonderful memories from Augusta Heritage and from Elkins, and Margot, I was delighted when she invited me to come back this year. 77 is the first year I was here taking that folklore class, and then came back in 78 and for two or three years after that teaching the storytelling classes. And this is something that's, you know, doesn't happen in very many other places in the world. And I think we're all real lucky, and I appreciate Margot's dedication to storytelling too, to always putting in each week the storytelling along with all the wonderful music and other crafts and events happening. But so many of my memories come from here, and a dear friend that I met back then that has remained a friend, Sue McRae Lewis, and she's here tonight too. And I always think about her with this story, because when I first met Sue and another friend, Janet Suter, both of them were working at the group home here in Elkins. And I have a dear friend also that is a Native American. He's a Chippewa Cree. And he said with his peoples, he was raised in a very traditional way, with his peoples that the mentally retarded, mentally handicapped people, are considered almost as messengers, what we might say as angels, sent here to teach us certain things. And I know being around Sue and Janet and the other folks here in Elkins, I always felt, you know, I got to go places like to go to a circus or to go to a potluck dinner or a dance with all of the folks. And I always felt a real sense of love there and also very much a sense of humor. And I hope you'll find both of those elements in this little story. It comes to me from a friend of a friend. And it's all about a young woman named Maureen and her friend Bobby. Now, Maureen, after she graduated from college, she lived out in Colorado, and she was a social services worker. And she was one of those people that just put her all into her job. Maybe you know someone like that. Maybe you are someone like that. But she realized that she was starting to get burned out. She lived in Boulder, Colorado, just outside of Denver. And so she decided what she would do is take a year and do something different. So she got a job as a bus driver. And she didn't want to get too far away, though, from her first love. So she became a bus driver for a social services agency. And she had a regular route that she would go on. She worked with the elderly and physically challenged, mentally handicapped, and would take them places that they needed to go, either to a doctor's appointment or a haircut, get their haircut, or wherever that was. Well, she had lots of stories to tell about her year as a bus driver, but some of her very favorite ones were about a young man named Bobby. He was retarded. She was about 24 years old when she knew him, and she described him by saying that he was a big chunk of a guy. If you were walking downtown alone at night and he was walking towards you, you'd probably be afraid, at least until he came close enough to where you could see his face, and then you'd realize there was such a gentleness there that there was no reason to be afraid. She said he always wore clothes that were a little bit too small, kind of high-water pants, coming about 6 or 7 inches off the ground there. And in the wintertime, he'd wear those old-fashioned kind of rubber boots. They had a clasp that would come over and attach around here. And he also, in the midst of Colorado winters, would wear those big, heavy Air Force jackets with the hood and fur. And those jackets, at least Bobby's, had two zippers.